Chapter 3. Aisha, Muhammad's wife and custodian of his memory, 680 CE. Muhammad had been left bereft at the death of Khadija, and a close friend advised him to remarry. He married two women at first, a widow named Sada, and a young daughter of one of his allies, Aisha. Later, Muhammad married other women, but in many ways Aisha was the most significant of his wives after Khadija. Aisha was not just the youngest, she was also the most beautiful of the Prophet's wives. Her father, Abu Bakr, had been an early and prominent Muslim, and he himself became the first caliph or successor to Muhammad after his death in 632 CE. Aisha was a mere child of 9 years when she was given in marriage to the Prophet in 623 CE. She survived him by several decades, not dying until she was 65. By that time, she had become a prominent figure in the community of Medina, and her life's story became integral to events that defined both the reception of the Quran and the development of the young Muslim community. Aisha was very intelligent, at once keenly observant and endowed with an exceptional memory. She remembered more than just the text of the Quran. She also knew more than most other Muslims about how and when and why the Quran was revealed. She witnessed and reminded others of the details of Muhammad's demeanor, from the smallest domestic encounters to the major public actions that shaped the Muslim community. It is thanks to this exceptional marriage between a man near the end of his life and a woman still near the beginning of hers that we know so much about both of them. Aisha had more than a quick mind and accurate memory. She also had a sharp tongue and was not afraid to speak the truth unadorned with niceties. Whenever she bested someone in argument, the Prophet would smile and say, "She is the daughter of Abu Bakr." A companion once said, "I have not seen anyone more eloquent than Aisha." During the Prophet's lifetime, she used to sit with other women and pass on the knowledge that she had received from Muhammad. In the decades after his death, she remained a source of knowledge and wisdom for both women and men. "Whenever a report appeared doubtful to us," noted one of the companions of the Prophet, "we asked Aisha about it, and we always learned something from her about it." She preferred the honorific title, the Mother of the Believers. It was a title of respect given to her and to all of the wives of the Prophet. "The Prophet is closer to the believers than their own selves, and his wives are as their mothers." Chapter 33, verse 6. But with the title also came certain duties and expectations. "O wives of the Prophet, if any of you are openly indecent, her penalty will be doubled, and that is easy for God. But any of you who is humble to God and God's messenger and acts with integrity, her we will reward doubly, and we have prepared a generous provision for her. O wives of the Prophet, you are not like any other women. If you are conscientious, don't be so submissive in speech that those with sickness in their hearts conceive desire, but do speak in civil terms. And settle down in your homes, and don't show off in public as was done in the time of ignorance. Pray regularly and give alms, and obey God and the Messenger of God. For God only wishes to remove defilement from you, people of the house, purifying you. And remember what is recited to you in your houses from the signs of God and wisdom, for God is subtle, aware." Chapter 33, verse 30 through 34. The wisdom of God, referred to in chapter 33, verse 34 and elsewhere, is taken to be the exemplary profile of the Prophet. Every aspect of life, from birth to death and everything that happens in between, was seen by Muslims through the behavior of Muhammad. It was this prophetic standard of behavior, the Sunnah, that Aisha helped to preserve and protect. Once she was asked to describe the Prophet. He was the Quran walking, replied Aisha, meaning that his behavior was the Quran translated into action. She did all that she could to preserve both the written Quran and the walking Quran, memorizing its verses and understanding them. At the same time, she knew and embodied the Sunnah. It was, in large part, due to her example that hadith, or traditions or reports about the Prophet, became conjoined with the Quran. If the Quran were God's inalterable word, then the Sunnah, as etched in hadith, became its complement and its extension. But Muhammad's unique status also placed a special burden on Aisha and his other wives. During his lifetime, his companions and other Muslims were expected to behave with respect and courtesy towards them. Targeted by the disbelievers and often molested by them, his wives wore the veil as a means of protection. They were also enjoined from marrying anyone else after his death. When you ask his wives for something that you need, ask them from behind a screen. That is purer for your hearts and their hearts. You have no right to annoy the Messenger of God or to marry his widows after his passing, ever. For that would be monstrous of you in the sight of God. Chapter 33, verse 53. Aisha maintained her purity, but perilously, because of the demands put upon her as the Prophet's youngest wife. During the course of her marriage to the Prophet Muhammad, the battles of Badr, Uhud, and the Trench were fought. These were the three major battles against the Quraysh, the major tribe of Mecca who opposed him, and shifted the balance of power out of the hands of the Quraysh and into the hands of the Muslims. Although she was still very young, Aisha participated in all three battles, bringing water for Muslim warriors and helping to look after the wounded. She witnessed life and she witnessed death, in the way of God as in the way of his opponents. She understood both, yet she affirmed life. Often when the Prophet went to war, he would draw lots to take one of his wives with him. In 626, when he went to fight the Banu al-Mustalik, the lot fell to Aisha. She was 13 years old. She accompanied the victorious Muslims, but on the way back to Medina, after a brief decampment, the Prophet unexpectedly ordered the army to continue the march back. Aisha had stepped out of the litter and gone behind a dune to relieve herself. Noticing that her necklace was missing, she searched in the sand for it. She lost track of time, and when she finally returned to the camp, only its traces remained. So light was she that the men carrying her litter could not tell whether or not she was in it, and they had left without her. Aisha sat down, waiting and hoping that someone would notice her absence and come back for her. No one did. But, fortunately for her, a young Muslim man who had fallen behind the army was trying to catch up when he reached the place where she had been left. He found Aisha lying fast asleep. Waking her up, he had her climb on the back of his own camel. Then, leading the camel by the hand, he set off on foot after the army, hoping that they would soon catch up. They did, but not until later the next morning, when the army had halted for a rest during the hottest part of the day. As luck would have it, some detractors had seen the two arrive together unaccompanied. Gossip and slanderous lies began to spread. Eventually, the story reached the Prophet. By then, the whole community was talking about what might or might not have happened between the two young Muslims as they returned home from the battle against the Banu al-Mustalik. The outcome of their affair seemed more consequential than the outcome of the battle. As a result of the gossip, the Prophet and his household came under great strain. No revelation came to clarify the matter. The Prophet, perhaps at the instigation of his cousin, Ali, questioned Barira, Aisha's maidservant. Had she detected anything amiss in Aisha's behavior? By him who sent you with the truth, replied Barira. I have seen nothing wrong with her, other than that she is a young girl, and sometimes she falls asleep while she is kneading the dough, and a lamb comes along and eats it. Some of the companions who were present scolded Barira. They prodded her to tell all that she knew. Glory be to God, she replied, I know as much about her as a jeweler knows about a piece of pure gold. The prophet then tried to vindicate Aisha's honor in public. Summoning everyone to the mosque, he defended her reputation. But the detractors, those who had instigated the trouble, also came to the mosque and provoked arguments about what the prophet meant. They almost came to blows over the matter. Finally, the prophet mounted the pulpit and, addressing the assembled believers, thundered, How does anyone dare to cast suspicion on the house of the prophet of God? He did not single out the accusers, but made each of the tribes responsible for the conduct of its members. The one most adamant in defaming Aisha's honor was handed over to his tribe to be punished by them. What had been a rumor mill became a matter of collective responsibility. Soon afterwards, Gabriel revealed to the prophet that Aisha was indeed innocent. Those who put forth the lie are a clique among you. Don't think it bad for you. No, it is better for you. Every one of them will get what he earned from the sin. And the one among them who took it upon himself to puff it up will have a tremendous punishment. When you heard it, why didn't the faithful men and women think the best on their own and say, This is an obvious lie? Why didn't they bring four witnesses to testify to it? If they didn't produce witnesses, then they are the liars in the sight of God. Why didn't you say, when you heard it, It is not for us to talk about this. By the glory of God, this is serious slander. God warns you not to revert to anything like this ever, if you are believers. And God makes the signs clear to you, for God is all-knowing, supremely wise. Chapter 24, verse 11 through 18. God makes the signs clear to you. This condemnation of slander occurs in the chapter of light. There is a lyrical hymn to light in verses 35 through 40, but the light here is moral. It is a blazing white light directed at the detractors. It upholds the honor of Aisha, but it also empowers women as well as men to be responsible for their own fate. A lie should be called a lie when it is an obvious untruth, hurting the reputation of other women. The affair of the lie, above all, illustrates the crucial principle at stake in interpreting the Quran. Not all signs are general dicta. Some have specific historical contexts, which illumine why certain verses were revealed, even as they set forth moral standards incumbent on Muslims in every age and in every place. After 626, no one could ignore the fact that Aisha's honor and reputation had been protected by divine decree. From then on, everyone became even more aware of her high station with God. For later codifiers of Islamic law, her embarrassment occasioned a very specific directive about false witnesses. As for those who accuse chaste women but fail to produce four witnesses, whip them 80 lashes and never take testimony from them ever, for they are the ones who are immoral. Chapter 24, verse 4. Not only is the virtuous woman then restored to honor when her accusers fail to make their case, but a heavy penalty falls on the false accusers. They forfeit their standing as devout Muslims. Worse than the marks of the lashes is the stigma of alienation from other Muslims. It never ceases. Its sting lasts forever. Another lingering effect of the affair of the lie was its impact on Aisha's relationship with Ali. Ali was among the family of the Prophet in a triple sense. Not only had he been with his cousin Muhammad since the earliest revelation, he had also fought in many of the major battles, and he had married Muhammad's oldest daughter by Khadija. Ali was among Muhammad's most trusted confidants, and so it was natural that the Prophet would have asked him about Aisha's dilemma. Ali is reported to have recommended questioning Aisha's slave girl Barira, and even after Barira defended Aisha, Ali is said to have favored divorcing her and marrying someone better. The ill will between them contributed to Aisha's subsequent decision to side with two other companions in opposing Ali as the fourth caliph, after he had become embroiled in conflict with relatives of his predecessor, Uthman. The result of this was the Battle of the Camel. Taking place in 656, it shaped the complex pattern of succession in Islam and opened the way to a new dynasty, the Umayyads, Meccan aristocrats linked to the third caliph, Uthman. But even before the affair of the lie, with its ominous sequel, their age difference and family rivalry must have exacerbated the tension between Ali and Aisha. Ali was younger than his cousin and father-in-law, Muhammad, but he was much older than Aisha, as was his wife, Fatima. It seems likely that the marriage of Muhammad to Aisha took place at almost the same time, in 623, as the marriage of Ali to Fatima. Both women sought the affection of the Prophet, one as a child bride, the other as a doting daughter. Aisha is said to have been jealous of Fatima, as she was of Ali's deceased mother-in-law, Khadija. Ali would have known the well-attested tradition about Aisha's jealousy of Khadija. Aisha was childless, while Khadija was not only the first Muslim, but also the mother of the Prophet's children. One day, under duress from the unfavorable comparison made between her and Khadija by other wives, Aisha's sharp tongue got the better of her good judgment. She derided her predecessor as "that toothless old woman whom God has replaced with a better." Muhammad rebuked her. "No, God has not replaced her with a better. She believed in me when I was rejected. When they called me a liar, she proclaimed me truthful. When I was poor, she shared with me her wealth, and God granted me her children, withholding those by other women." The irony of this tradition is that it is supported by an impeccable authority, Aisha herself. Aisha was honest, even when she was at fault. In other traditions that she reported, she vented her irritation with fellow wives, their jealousies and competition for the affection of a husband whose main concern was to be the faithful prophet of God and the advocate of his community. Aisha is said to have recorded more than 2,000 traditions of the prophet. It is a prodigious feat matched by only three other companions, none of whom was as close to the Prophet or as jealous of his affection as was Aisha. To the extent that women's rights remain central to defining the ethos of Islam, Aisha was a pioneer whose example continues to inspire Muslim women and to elicit the respect of Muslim men.